Welcome to No Limits. I'm Jill Sheridan in today for John Kroll. I'm a reporter here at WFYI and with Indiana Public Broadcasting, and today, your host. Today, the conversation will be about neighborhood change in Indianapolis in recent years. If you'd like to join this conversation today, our phone lines are down, so send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or Twitter at WFYI. Our guests today will be Matt Nowlin from the IUPUI Paulus Center, Matt Davis, who is an artist and founder of Axiom Collective, and Chris Pyre with the Metropolitan Indianapolis Board of Realtors. Thank you so much for joining us today. And now, this news. Hello and welcome to No Limits. I am Jill Sheridan in today for John Kroll, who is on vacation. I'm a reporter here at WFYI and for the Indiana Public Broadcasting Statewide Network and your host. Today, the conversation is focused on neighborhood change here in Indianapolis in recent decades, and this is following a report from the Paulus Center, IUPUI, and the Savvy Group, who put together this report to sort of look at general trends in population, in housing and income, and how Indianapolis metro areas had changed since 1970, since the formation of UNIGOV. Now, I talk to people about this issue all the time, and it just is something people are very passionate about, people that are from Indianapolis. I think it's because people drive through the neighborhoods and they see the changes. It's so tangible. You can really understand how neighborhoods are investing or not investing and see that as you're driving around. So I'd like to throw the first question to Matt Nowlin from IUPUI Paulus Center, who was one of the researchers and authors of this report that came out this past spring. Matt, what were your big takeaways and how did you sort of focus this report and the reasons why behind it?
Yeah, well, Jill, like you mentioned, when you drive through certain neighborhoods, you can see on the ground some obvious changes. But sometimes it's a little harder to capture those changes in data. Take, for example, Fountain Square, which I think anecdotally is a quickly changing neighborhood just from people's experience there. But when you look at certain demographic characteristics and income statistics, it's actually the second highest poverty rate neighborhood in Marion County. The assessed value there for a home is – the median assessed value is $55,000, even though we know of a lot of homes that are selling there for over $200,000 and $300,000. So sometimes that data doesn't match up with the story of change that we're hearing. Mm-hmm. So we were interested in putting together a methodology that could see that level of neighborhood change in places like that. So we looked at change in a few factors. We looked at the total population of an area, the percent of that area that's white, the percent of that area that has a bachelor's degree, the average family income there, and also the percent of the neighborhood that is between the ages of 20 and 34. So we thought these matched up well with like indicating neighborhood demand and also with the demographics that are usually considered the gentrifiers, white, young, educated, higher income people. And so what we found is this is really an effective way to kind of measure change on the ground. It matches with what people are experiencing. And part of the reason it does is because we're not just looking to find, for example, the wealthiest neighborhoods or the whitest neighborhoods, things like that, but we're actually looking at how neighborhoods have changed. So looking at places like Mapleton Fall Creek, where still three-quarters of the population are people of color. So it's not a very white area. But the share of white people in that neighborhood has grown eightfold since 2000. So with this, we're able to see not just where neighborhoods are now, but which ones are changing really quickly.
Yeah. And you look at it in this report, a number of specific areas in Indianapolis and the surrounding areas, because this report talks a lot about suburbanization. East Franklin, 38th and Arlington are the neighborhoods, Southeast Greenwood, also downtown Carmel, Fall Creek Place, and Mapleton Fall Creek. I should, again, say our guests today, and I apologize, Chris Pryor with MyBar, Realtor Association, and also Matt Davis, who is an artist and founder of of Axiom Collective. So again, thank you everyone for joining today. Chris, I might ask you, you know, when you look at these changes, and I know you've taken a great look at this report and seen, you know, these market-driven changes throughout recent decades, how does the metrics and the information that's in a report like this really able to inform us of what's happening in central Indiana?
Well, thank you, Jill. We've certainly seen some dramatic changes in a lot of our neighborhoods, and I think there's some great things happening, a lot of reinvestment happening in our neighborhoods, which is great to see. And I think that, you know, a lot of the things you're seeing are market-driven as a result of people's changing preferences. And so you see a lot of folks today have a new interest or a renewed interest in living in urban areas where they can be in walkable communities, that they can easily access shops, restaurants, entertainment, recreation like the Cultural Trail or Monon Trail, things of that nature. And so people are looking for a different product than they maybe have for the last 20, 30 years. And so you're seeing a resurgence, if you will, of a lot of our downtown neighborhoods. People take interest in moving back to those places that have the amenities that they're looking to be close to.
Mm-hmm. And I would like anyone to join the conversation today. Unfortunately, our phone lines are down, but you can send an email, nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Matt Davis, artist and founder of Axiom Collective. You grew up in Indianapolis. You are a young man, but have seen, you know, the changes here and have seen how those have influenced, you know, the cultural aspects of the city of Indianapolis. And we, you know, talked a lot, I know, when we took a first look at this report about, you know, the importance of art and culture and how everyone wants that in right. their neighborhoods. And when we took a look at, you know, Fountain Square neighborhood as a perfect example of that. What sort of change have you seen around the cultural and artistic world here in Indianapolis and how that reflects on neighborhoods?
Yeah, I feel like as soon as Indianapolis has a housing market and a market for with an actual downtown, that's when you saw kind of a boom of the art scene, early 2000s, you know, when the cultural districts kind of came together, Mass Ave, Briar Ripple, when all of that started to get formal. It also affected the kind of just arts community and informal scene as well. And I think what we've seen in a lot of different examples like the Earth House or Big Car, and those are kind of two different extremes along the spectrum. But you see all of these groups, whether it's intentional or not, being involved in the development process, the process of making an area cool. So, and if you relate that directly to these metrics, and especially along the lines of age and race, and you know, this is what we consider to be the gentry. You know, you can't have gentrification without the gentry, people with disposable income. I'm 20, I just want to be cool, I'm gonna move to the Fountain Square, I'm in a band, I'm doing this. But you're also in a development process. There's also something happening in that neighborhood that's larger than just what you're participating in. And I think that people are becoming more and more aware of that, especially from the arts-based perspective, as we see these neighborhoods change from the impact of what happened the last time that a neighborhood was becoming cool. And where is it at now? The small businesses come in, then the bigger chains come in, different interests come in. And so I think that the arts community is becoming more sensitive to that and is creating art that's speaking to it as well. So.
Matt Nowlin, who was one of the researchers on this report, I would maybe like for you to talk a little bit about Fall Creek Place, because I know that that really stood out as a neighborhood that you know, had seen such great change, such immense change, I guess I should say, and that was really clear in the data.
Yeah, absolutely. after we ran this analysis, one thing we wanted to do was to see which neighborhoods had changed the fastest in each decade.
The changiest, I
think. Yeah, we called it anecdotally the changiest neighborhoods. Fall Creek Place turned out to be one of the fastest changing in a 10-year period out of all neighborhoods, out of all periods, from 1970 till now. And the period in which it changed really fast was from 2000 to 2010, which is when there was a really intense development effort focused there. So intense, as Jeff Bennett says, something like that will never happen again probably, just because of the level of coordination that it brought to bring all those different resources to bear on that one neighborhood. And so the changes we saw were significant increases in the proportion of the population that's white, really significant increases in income there. The educational attainment increased a lot, and it went from being kind of below average in terms of attracting folks who are 20 to 34 years old to being one of the highest populations of that age group in the whole region. Meanwhile, the population itself increased slightly, but not that much. So I think this is interesting because Fall Creek Place is mentioned as having, you know, a very high vacancy rate before redevelopment, and some of the need to redevelop it was not only just quality of life in the neighborhood, but in general the depopulation of Indianapolis and in particular Center Township. So Center Township peaked in terms of population in 1950 and since then has lost about half its population. So we're talking about going from about 300,000 folks in Center Township in 1950 to 150,000 or so now. And so, you know, it's difficult for a city to operate when it it's difficult to kind of meet the bottom line when you have such extreme population loss and therefore like tax base loss. So I see the need to kind of repopulate and bring density into neighborhoods like this. But what's interesting in Fall Creek Place is while the population did increase moderately, it went up by about 300 folks from 2000 to 2010. The biggest changes really happened in terms of who lived there. So it went from being almost all people of color to being half white, half people of color. And the income, the average family earnings there increased dramatically. So it wasn't as simple as like we were just bringing more people here. It really changed who lived in the neighborhood. And some of the people that used to live there did leave. We can see that in the numbers.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of people left Indianapolis neighborhoods and will likely never return in the numbers that they were back in the 70s for a number of reasons here in the city. You know, when we're talking about investment, Chris, how important is it that, you know, we really understand that it takes a coordinated effort, that this investment can really make good things happen in central Indiana, in the Indianapolis area?
Right. Well, I mean, we touched on kind of the market-driven aspect of this and, you know, people wanting to live in urban areas where they're walkable communities. But another key piece of this in a lot of areas is that investment that's being coordinated by a lot of different groups. You know, mm-hmm. The city is a big investor in a lot of these initiatives a lot of times, along with a lot of community development organizations. And it used to – the way we approached neighborhood revitalization in the past was really kind of a scattered approach where there were lots of different organizations and efforts happening in small little pieces across the city. But there is today a much more coordinated effort to bring all those resources together to be able to impact change on a much quicker scale, on a larger scale, and really drive private investment along with that investment from the city and from community development groups.
Mm-hmm. And we've seen that, you know, in a number of the areas that were sort of highlighted in this report, including, you know, investment in an area like Carmel. I mean, that was a coordinated effort, you know, in the downtown in the Carmel area is a different place than it was 10 years ago.
Absolutely. But there's also, you know, still that market component to it that, you know, what you're seeing happening in downtown Carmel. You know, is they're kind of creating their own downtown. It may not be kind of authentic older neighborhoods where you're seeing a lot of things happen in Indianapolis, but Carmel's kind of taking that trend and adopting it to make it fit in their community and making a walkable community that people desire to be in.
Mm-hmm. And Matt, when we're talking about I'm throwing it to Matt, so that's not confusing at all. Matt Davis, when we're talking, you know, about this report, it looks a lot at gentrification, and you know,
right.
it's kind of an iffy word, but we're bringing it out into the open. You know, we're saying, mm-hmm. you know, that this is something that's real. When you look at the numbers and the information here, what does it tell you?
I think it's really just a more accurate scope of what displacement is actually happening and what isn't, you know, because I think that that's what's up underneath gentrification is the gentry come and everyone else has to leave. And even the way that the metrics are set up in terms of the indicators of change, it's around the demographic makeup of who the gentry are, you know, white, educated, you know, in a certain age range. So I think it's just more speaking to the core issue. Mm-hmm. And I'm really glad that it exists now.
We will be back, but I do invite you to join the conversation. Send an email today at nolimits@wfyi.org. Again, we'll be back talking about neighborhood change today here on 90.1 WFYI, No Limits. Welcome back to No Limits. I am Jill Sheridan, and today for John Kroll, I'm a reporter here at WFYI and for Indiana Public Broadcasting, the statewide network, and your host. Today we're talking about neighborhood change in Indianapolis and surrounding areas, this following a report from the Paulus Center and the Savvy Group, and a request for that link at this very interesting report. It's at Savvy. That's SAVI.org/neighborhood change. And when we're giving out addresses here, I would love for you to join the conversation. Unfortunately, our phones are down today, but you can email us nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook and send us a message. That's at nolimits@wfyi or on Twitter at WFYI, just like Bradley has done. And I wanted to pick back up with you, Matt Davis, who is a founder of Axiom Collective, as we're discussing gentrification. He would like us to address, you know, the issue of people in these gentrified neighborhoods that are no longer to afford, that can no longer afford to live in the house that they've lived in, you know, their whole life. That's a big part of it. That's what we see, you know, happening. Mm-hmm. And that's why people get upset by gentrification. Have you experienced that and people that you've talked to in neighborhoods that have been displaced?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think that it first kind of starts off with just a cultural shift. Just the again, it's those art events and the placemaking efforts that make people feel comfortable at looking at property a different way. And he was just speaking to, like, oh, there could be amenities here that I would like. Mm-hmm. And so then you see development of strips, and then that leads into development of houses. And it's just it's a gradual process. But I think that displacement happens later on. But the fact that there's so much tension in the buildup to it is what ultimately, you know, leads to the displacement, or the people who are already existing there don't feel like there's an option at all. You see what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And so then when there are rent increases and property taxes go up, it almost already felt inevitable anyway. So, of course, there's tension with people who are already living in these neighborhoods, especially if they're generational families. But some people might have just only lived there for a decade. They're just as upset.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I think that a lot of times it does happen along the lines of race. This report is definitely reflecting that. And the metrics for who we see the gentry as is focused on that identity. And that is how the market is shaped, too. Even in a more, you know, financial, you know, from a more financial perspective, that's the target audience, you know. And so we see 80% AMI, you know, when really most people's socioeconomic status is more 50% AMI. Right. And so affordable housing solutions have to start looking at this from a more mm-hmm. holistic perspective. And this report can help with doing that. And also the people who are in the art based processes of making the neighborhood cool need to look at this report, too. Right. Mm-hmm. And have a more nuanced approach of art making and the outcomes of their work. So,
Chris, people feel like that, you know, they don't have housing options. Do communities and organizations need to make that more of a priority, you know, when we're considering gentrification?
Well, absolutely. I think that when you see, especially when there are coordinated efforts to revitalize an area, there needs to be a focus on the affordable housing component of that as well to make sure that we're not forcing everybody out of the neighborhood. I would push back a little bit on what Matt said. I don't think you're forcing everybody out, but certainly that I don't want to also not acknowledge the real pressures that are there with, mm-hmm. you know, increasing rents and property taxes. Those are real concerns, and we do have to look at solutions for those and find opportunities to make sure that we can keep those residents in the neighborhood. And I think that, you know, we can't forget that we're creating great opportunities for people with a lot of this revitalization as well that is, you know, kind of often being overlooked because of the displacement issue, which, again, can't be ignored. But we also need to make sure that we're paying attention to the fact that we're creating, you know, a better quality of life in these neighborhoods, or reducing crime, or creating more job opportunities. So there are some positive benefits as well. And so it's important to find a good balance to those.
Mm-hmm. I would say that, you know, most people would not disagree that, you know, Indianapolis has grown and changed so much over the past 40 some years. And I would say in a mostly positive way. I mean, certainly the city is better off financially. It's just a more vibrant city than I've seen in recent decades. I would love for you to join the conversation today. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook, No Limits WFYI, just as Gary has done. And he says he's interested in hearing more about the statistics, the demographics that are associated with income inequality and whether or not crime has gone down or changed from a violent non-crime. Now, Matt Nowlin, who is a researcher on this recent study from the Polis Center at IOPUI. I know this report didn't necessarily look at crime, but when we're looking at the statistics and the demographics, can they tell us anything about, you know, how those might be correlated with income inequalities?
That would be a good next step. We have a lot of, like, research questions we'd like to follow up on. So, and like you said, in this report, we didn't look at how crime or income inequality relates to gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
There is an interesting article, if you go to that link, savvy.org/neighborhoodchange, on a neighborhood that wasn't highlighted in the report but did change rather quickly, which is the area, west of Crown Hill,
mm-hmm.
Which is kind of the Golden Hill neighborhood and Riverside area. And that neighborhood in particular has seen some signs of gentrification, also has some of the highest income inequality of any neighborhood in the city. And I think part of that is just how it's built. So there's an interesting question when it comes to income inequality at a small scale. So if you think about measuring income inequality, you have a city's worth of people, and you want to figure out, okay, do the top 10% own, you know, outsized share of the wealth, for example? So maybe the top 10% make 80% of the income or something like that, right? But it gets more complicated when you go down to the neighborhood level, because in that case, income inequality can really be just a sign of different development patterns. So in the case of Golden Hill and Riverside, Golden Hill is a very wealthy place, a historic area of mansions built on the site of a former industrial magnate. And Riverside is a lower income, like historically black community. And they're right next to each other. So that creates the income inequality. But, you know, maybe you look at that and think, well, that's a good thing because it's also like income diversity. It's people of two different income levels living in proximity, which is good. So
mm-hmm. when we look at, you know, yeah, income diversity is, mm-hmm. is another issue that, you know, I don't think we talk a lot about, but it's clearly, you know, it's clearly there when you look at these neighborhoods. You look at the difference between a place like, you know, Greenwood and a place like Carmel with no income inequalities. Chris Pryor joining us from MyBar today. This question from a person that emailed us. I would love for you to join us. Email us at nolimits@wfyi.org. And Kenny, she asks, you know, people who are already living in these neighborhoods for many generations, when we say that, you know, people are interested in moving back downtown, what we're all actually talking about is, again, displacing legacy residents with people that have higher income and it's racially motivated. And a lot of times these legacy neighbors of color don't understand the culture and the history. So she wants us to, you know, comment further on the gentrification issue. I don't know, Chris, or actually Matt, if you'd be interested in talking about Kenny's question.
Well, I think that there are some important issues raised there, and we need to make sure that we're paying attention to those, that we're not displacing all residents when you see reinvestment happening in neighborhoods. There are ways, I think, that we can address some of those. Resources can be put into affordable housing and different aspects, but we shouldn't discount those. But at the same time, again, I think that we're also we don't want to just sound the alarm and say that we shouldn't have any of these reinvestments because of the negative impacts of this. There's also lots of positives that are going on. So we need to find that appropriate balance to making that work for everybody.
I think that's what everyone appreciated about this report was that, you know, it's talking about change and not necessarily improvement, which isn't really the issues that we're talking about today. It's just looking at, you know, the change and how that has impacted the people living in these communities in the Indianapolis area. And it's certainly in a multi-layered way. So again, for you to join the conversation, you can email us, nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or Twitter at wfyi. Unfortunately, our phone lines are down today. But I know, Matt, we had talked, Matt Davis, who is a founder of Axiom Collective, we had talked a little bit about, you know, the importance of schools, too. And when we look historically at schools in Indianapolis and how that, you know, has driven a lot of the suburbanization, the importance of investing and having, you know, community backing of the schools in Indianapolis and in the neighborhoods. Important, yes?
Yeah, there's a lot of factors to how a neighborhood is seen as valuable and a place to move to. Like Chris was kind of speaking to some of that and just had a sensitivity around people aren't forced into it, and I definitely agree there. I just think that there's a way that the process happens that definitely does have kind of an agitating effect with the people who already live there. So if you look at redlining and the history of redlining and how that relates to schools and property taxes and how that becomes like a really vicious cycle for investment and pathways out of poverty through education, through employment, you see what I mean? Through being able to meet your basic needs, how that relates to crime. So it's a very, very intricate web that really relates back to federal policies that build in a bias into how a neighborhood is developed. Schools are central to that. If you look at more affluent areas, the areas where white people flew to during white flight and how they maintain political power through UNIGOV, which is different than Cleveland or which is different than Detroit, where people of color got left in the middle of the city with some political power, not much economic power, though, right? You could run for office or something like that, right? But you didn't have a strong economic base. In Indianapolis, white people took everything to the donut. So it left Center Township pretty in the gutter. I mean, Matt can speak more to the numbers on that. But if you look, the schools were also impacted by that, too. And I think we're seeing the revival of these neighborhoods, but we're also seeing strategic CFIs and certain innovation schools, different private alternative, private options, you know, popping up to help spur the development, especially the housing. And I feel like it's all connected the same way that we got in this issue. It was a very, you know, a strategic system that allowed for a certain type of development to happen or underdevelopment to happen. And I think we're seeing, you know, schools being put in another pivotal role again in terms of providing options for people who have more disposable income or looking for a certain type of neighborhood. So,
yeah, and certainly, you know, that's top of mind to people that are moving back in the city and people that are, you know, considering repopulating Center Township, which I know the numbers will probably never be to where they were before. Matt Nowlin, I'd like to ask you, you know, Phil emails us today, and welcome anyone to email us, nolimits@wfyi.org. He'd like to know more exactly, you know, where we see the most gentrification in these neighborhoods, according to the report.
Okay. Yeah. Let me touch on what Matt was saying before I get to that. First of all, I agree. Schools are an interesting component here in terms of neighborhood change. And actually, we just got finished with a meeting of the savvy analysts back at the office, kind of talking about what report to develop as a follow-up to this, and we're going to be studying that relationship between education and neighborhood change. But also what Matt was getting to about some of the federal policies and real estate practices and things that built inequity into the market system, I think that's important to keep in mind. Because though a lot of the worst, most obvious policies are behind us, and, you know, they're not on the books anymore in terms of redlining and blockbusting, and lending has a lot more transparency and equity now. The damage those caused are still inherent and kind of ripple throughout the system from generation to generation. And so I point that out to say that the difficult thing about placemaking and place-based strategies and neighborhood improvement is that at the end of the day, while communities and places are built up of a lot of different things, including neighbors and culture, but one of those things is it's real estate, and it's a commodity to be bought and sold, right? And so as you make that commodity more desirable, it becomes more expensive. And so you know, it's possible that to address some of the difficulties and inequities we see in Indianapolis, we need to go upstream before neighborhood and before place to issues like access to jobs and income for lower wage jobs and service industry jobs and things like that, and access to equal quality education. And so affect change in the ways that really make an impact on people's quality of life, their education and their earnings. And then they can decide to make the market choices they want to with that income, right? And if it's moved to this neighborhood or that neighborhood, then they have that choice. But I think that we need to look upstream in terms of the economic inequalities and problems we face.
Mm-hmm. Please, go ahead.
Oh, and then to answer, sorry, was it Phil?
Yes.
To answer Phil's question, we saw gentrification kind of start in the 80s with areas downtown by IUPUI and along Mass Ave. And then it really seemed to spread the fastest in the 2010s kind of the 2000s and the 2010s. And it spread significantly up College and Meridian on that kind of northern corridor, and then also started to spread east and southeast. So think about neighborhoods like Holy Cross, Fountain Square. And so, yeah, those are kind of the phases that we saw.
Matt talked a little bit about this, Chris, when you're looking at, from the outside, looking in at Indianapolis, you know, and people that are moving into the city and the neighborhoods, what are you hearing from, you know, people that are looking out from the in? I'm just kind of interested to know.
Well, you kind of hit on a couple of different topics with some of these recent comments from mm-hmm. from both Matt's, but I think schools is a huge factor. I think mm-hmm. that, you know, for a long time, Indianapolis kind of suffered from a negative perception with their schools, and I think that still exists to some extent with some of our surrounding communities. But I think there's been great strides made in our school system here. IPS has made great progress on improving test scores and graduation rates. Mm-hmm. There are also lots of additional options for education here. So I think that has really opened the opportunity up for people to reconsider Marion County as an option when education, which we know is one of the top factors in where somebody chooses to purchase a home, they have more opportunities now to think about that. So, and I think that, again, we were talking that a lot of these recent changes have been seen by people's new interest in renewed urbanization and some of the coordinated reinvestment efforts that are going on there.
And again, today on No Limits, we are talking about neighborhood change in recent decades here in the city. Our guests are Matt Nowland from the IUPUI Paulus Center, Matt Davis, who is an artist and founder of Axiom Collective, and also Chris Pyre with MyBar Realtor Association. Please join the conversation, No Limits at WFYI.org, or find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI. We will be back shortly to continue the conversation right here on 90.1 WFYI. Welcome back to No Limits. I'm Jill Sheridan, and today for John Kroll. I'm a reporter at WFYI and with Indiana Public Broadcasting, the statewide reporting network, and your host today. Today's conversation is revolving around neighborhood change in recent decades in the city of Indianapolis and surrounding areas, a topic that's people are very passionate about. So that's why we're happy to bring it up today. And this is following a report out of IUPUI Paulus Center. Matt Nowlin was one of the researchers there. We would love to have you join us today. No Limits at WFYI.org. That's how you can email us. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or Twitter at No Limits or at WFYI. That's Twitter. So unfortunately, our phones are down today, so you cannot call us. But we would love for you to join the conversation anyway. Chris Pryor from MIBOR, we're talking about, you know, making sure that the scope of neighborhood change and the importance of investing in areas that are not necessarily highlighted in this report, that we highlight that here today, because that's an important part when we're looking at the Indianapolis area.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Jill. I think that the topic of gentrification is again, something that we need to stay close to. But I've been concerned in recent months at how often I hear the term and how often, you know, it's just associated with some of the challenges brought about by neighborhood reinvestment. And again, we need to make sure that we're addressing those and not forgetting how to make sure people can stay in the neighborhoods. But we also have to remember that in totality, I mean, we're talking a small portion that's we're seeing these issues happen in Marion County. The large portion of Marion County is still suffering from a lot of disinvestment and decline in our neighborhoods. And we need to make sure that we're not scaring off opportunities, if you will, to continue to invest in those neighborhoods and bring those back so that they're great, thriving neighborhoods that people want to live in. So I just want to make sure that we're not overlooking that bigger issue to me.
I mean, people get excited when there's investments in neighborhoods. I know that, you know, I've seen it happen through the last, you know, 30 years here in Indianapolis. And it's exciting to me to see when, you know, things are becoming vibrant and people care mm-hmm. about a place. And so that's why people are very passionate about this. You can email us today if you'd like to join the conversation. No Limits at WFYI.org, as Mackenzie has done today. She points out that she just moved into a neighborhood that she feels like is gentrifying. She lives on Shadeland Avenue near Irvington. We know that area not highlighted in the report, but is always changing. She's noticed in her apartment building that is majority African-American and Hispanic. She's concerned that the people in her apartment building, the people running it, seem to be interested in bringing more white people than anything. Again, we're talking about race, Matt. And I know that, you know, when we had this panel discussion, that's a topic that we need to just bring out there and talk openly about.
Oh, it's definitely out there already.
What would you say, you know, to someone like Mackenzie that's worried about that in her apartment building?
Well, I feel like, you know, from the property owner's perspective, it's kind of some of the considerations that Chris was just bringing up. He's like, well, this is where the market is at. Here's some opportunity. This is definitely a target audience to shape my investment strategy around, right? Whether I'm a property owner of an apartment complex or, you know, some commercial building, residential, whatever it is. That's kind of the lens, right? Mm-hmm. And that's a healthy lens to have, especially if you're kind of operating in the development process from that standpoint. But there's more than just one target audience in development, I feel like. And we need to look at investment strategies that are really taking into consideration everyone who's already in the neighborhood, too. And I think that that's what's unique about this report is talking about the changes, not the return on investments, right? So I think that we have a market-driven perspective that looks at the returns a lot, but not so much what have been the actual changes on a pragmatic level, and how can we shape investment around that, not only for people that we want to attract and retain, but people who are already there, too. Because that's that mixed income type of, you know, perspective that we know is more resilient, is more sustainable long term for a lot of reasons. So I feel like for anybody who's just on a tenant level or just on a renter level or just a homeowner or someone who's just cares about community and wants to see things along the lines of race and class happen differently in their neighborhood. I think it's about engaging in the process of how to shape the neighborhood differently. So neighborhood associations. So my board has to have good relationships with neighborhood associations. And so people getting involved on that level, getting involved in community initiatives, different things like quality of life plans. You know, there's so many different opportunities that aren't usually shared, and people aren't, you know, don't feel so comfortable to readily engage in those things because of some of those kind of biased things that we were speaking about before the break. And so I feel like those walls are coming down, and I feel like the people, again, the hipsters, the coolsters who are making the neighborhoods appealing, not only from a market lens, but also just from a community, I like my neighbors kind of perspective too. There's a unique opportunity to kind of soften those barriers for someone like her, mm-hmm. you know. So get involved some way, even if it's art or some kind of neighborhood participation. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And Jill, if I could, I mean, I would totally agree with that. I mean, I think that this needs to be a multi-layered process, that it's not just, in, you know, the investors and developers that are making decisions, or you know, city government. It needs to be citizens. It needs to be all those folks that are involved in the process need to come to the table and be part of the process. And one thing I was just going to add to this mix is, I mentioned, you know, government needs to be there. A lot of this is dictated by government policy too, development policy on what we're doing for, you know, allowing the size of lots and square footage on homes is really, especially in our surrounding communities, we're seeing a big issue with, you know, they're really driving the price of housing up because they're not wanting, you know, small square footage on small lots. So on dense products, they're wanting to spread things out, which is driving the cost up. And so we need to address all of those issues, even within Marin County, to make sure that we can have a diversity of housing options, both at price and type of homes that are available to folks.
Mm-hmm. I like the idea of having, you know, more people in the community really having their voice heard, because when people are, you know, when people do have their voice heard about the neighborhood, then people listen. But mm-hmm. when people sit back and don't, maybe things are missed a lot. I'd like you, Matt Nowlin, if you'd like to comment too about, you know, those, just the scope of Indianapolis, and we're looking at, you know, the areas that maybe were left out of this report and moving forward.
Well, we did look at kind of, rather than thinking about change from one decade to another, we took another angle in this report as well and looked at, okay, for each of these indicators, what's the overall change we've seen over the past 5 decades? And that shows some big issues that face people of all races all across Marion County, which is, in a lot of areas in the county, we've seen average family income, I should say, declined significantly. So we're talking about half of all people in Marion County live in neighborhoods or census tracts where the average family income has fallen more than 16%, and that's adjusted for inflation. So that's the northwest side, the northeast side, the southwest side, the southeast side. Basically, much of Marion County, except kind of downtown, north of downtown, Broad Ripple, the Geist area, and part of the southeast part of the county. So a lot of Marion County, like I said, half of all residents are living in places where income has declined. So this is something that, you know, can unify neighborhoods and unify people around solving issues like that. I just think that those issues are bigger and deeper than sense of place or than how appealing a neighborhood is or looks. And on that note, I think it's really important to remember in this whole discussion that sometimes we can get a real kind of flat, shallow perspective of what a good neighborhood is and a bad neighborhood, and base that on kind of how it looks and feels to us as we are walking through it or driving through it. And we need to remember that those neighborhoods that may look like the housing stock is lower quality and there's not been investment in a few decades still are full of families and citizens that matter to each other and should matter to us as residents of this whole community.
What's next for the report? I mean, you guys are planning another report. Yes, you're going to be looking at
right.
some other issues this fall.
I can't we haven't figured out the exact hypothesis yet.
But, don't tell us.
But like I said, we're going to look at the relationship between how neighborhoods are changing and how schools are changing.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure exactly what that will look like.
Won't get you in trouble.
But no,
breaking
you won't.
Any news here.
It's not like it's a secret. We just don't know yet. So.
Well, there's certainly lots of root issues to explore here, and you do have some time to join the conversation. We're talking about neighborhood change today. You can email us, nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or Twitter at WFYI. Emailing us today is Sam from Terre Haute. He's actually not even from Indianapolis, but listening there, and he talks about the market maybe not being the problem or being the problem actually, and he also talks about people, activists in the communities that may oppose change and investment because it might be likely to lead to displacement or gentrification. And saying that the market is driving that, and that people living in these neighborhoods or activists wouldn't even want the affordable housing. Is that a problem here, Chris?
Trying to make sure I understand your question, but you're saying that
people in the communities are opposed to change and investment because they don't want to see their neighborhoods change. Culturally, I guess. Maybe I should.
Yes, it sure. Sounds like the assumption is along the lines of right. Like in that target audience type of, that's kind of what I'm hearing.
Would you like to answer that one, Matt?
I feel like activists or organizers or people who are engaged socially, they want to see a certain type of change. They do want to see improved. They do want to see capital investments. They want to see better commercial real estate. They want to see better housing. But they just want it to happen differently, and they want it to happen in a more inclusive way, in a more equitable way.
Mm-hmm.
I think sometimes where there's some short-sightedness, and I've been involved in this, I've learned from these type of things too, when you're advocating for certain solutions, something like a community land trust or something that's a big collaborative project,
mm-hmm.
You have to work with people who work in the financial sector and work in development in a way where it's collaborative, and you kind of want to align interests to a point where the solutions can be viable. You can have the technical assistance from people who work in the field. You can have the community input from people who are passionate, in terms of participating in the organizations. And then you just want the everyday resident perspective, too. So I think that's you see the most sustainable solutions when it's more collaborative across different interests and across different perspectives. And so, me and Chris should work together on a land trust.
I know you should.
and let me add something to that. I think maybe where this question was going was with the affordability question and
mm-hmm.
people being resistant to that. And we do see that in a lot of our communities that I think the term affordable housing kind of has a stigma, has a perception with people. And it's often, I think people define it as Section 8 housing, but affordable housing is really much broader than that. I mean, it can be all points of the price spectrum, but we're talking about, homes that can be, $150,000 or $125,000, $175,000 or $250,000. Some of those price ranges, we're not even talking about, Section 8, which often is what people jump to. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that we need to overcome in our conversations with our communities when we're talking about some of these issues, is affordability is a much broader term than people kind of have it in their mind, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Can I say one thing about the market
part?
I think that also people who lean more to the social justice perspective need to start looking at options, whether it's housing, especially housing, about taking things off of the market completely and trying to do solutions like things like land trusts and other kind of, interesting covenant type of strategies
mm-hmm.
Where you can take things off of the market, more wealth building strategies. I just wanted to put that out there to people who are listening and saying, well, I think the issue is capitalism or something way big and hairy.
Right.
Okay, well, what does that look like on a neighborhood scale
mm-hmm.
in a way that's pragmatic?
Uh-huh. We have seen that happen in Indianapolis and successfully. So I did want to, approach another email here that we got. We were talking about schools, and this person writes that that she'd like to fight back against the negative IPS perception. She's 31 years old, married, and her friends and families have kids, and she does not want to move. She feels like, you know, there's a lot that the community can do to sort of relay that message, the positive message of IPS, and we the schools here have had a lot of success, and I know you touched on that. Maybe again we could sort of emphasize that.
Right. I mean, I guess from my perspective, I mean, I think there's been a lot of progress made in that in the perception side of it. And along with the progress made by the school itself, and that's, you know, led to improved perception. But it still, I mean, it's kind of an entrenched view of the schools in Marion County for a lot of folks that, you know, have held these beliefs for a long time. And so it's going to be a long process to change minds, right? But I think that, again, you know, IPS in particular, I know, has made tremendous progress on test scores and graduation rates. And I don't think people are fully aware of some of the great things that they've done. And we need to do a better job of touting their success and making sure people are aware that there are good options for schools if you want to live in Marion County.
Mm-hmm. And certainly so many, you know, of these root issues that are associated with the change in the neighborhoods here in Indianapolis. I know we're coming up against the end of the show here. So I do appreciate everyone joining. Maybe we can hit on Ryan joined us on Facebook today, and he's, you know, concerned that some neighborhood and area associations create new projects that sound the groundwork for gentrification, but don't really allow that community involvement, don't allow that feedback. Matt, maybe you could respond to that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that just kind of speaks to that broader issue of how these biases for how development should happen are built into the processes, mm-hmm. whether it's the art-making process to make it appealing, placemaking, the actual, you know, development of the commercial strip or housing, you know. It's kind of, when it's baked into the process, it's hard to get around it. Mm-hmm. And so that's why, you know, residents and people who are engaged in community activities, it's important for them to participate, because we have to start to advocate for different practices to work in concert with the more conventional market-driven, you know, ways that things happen. So I think it's just about creating balance. It's not always easy, but you always find much more support when you find small ways to advocate that can have a big impact. And because, again, this report should give people more confidence to do that and be more strategic about how they want to do that and say, if I'm really doing something in housing, am I just an affordable housing enthusiast, or am I getting involved in a way that can really move the needle on how many already existing people in this neighborhood now have opportunity for home ownership or something like
that.
Go
out there and get your hands dirty. Savvy.org/neighborhood change is where you can see all this information. I do want to thank our guests, Matt Nowlin from the IUPUI Paula Center, Matt Davis, artist and creator of Axiom Collective, and Chris Pyre from MyBoar. I'm Jill Sheridan in today for John Krall. Thank you so much for joining us on No Limits here at 90.1 WFYI.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.